This is the last day of this November 2010 seven-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the Blue Cliff Record collection of koans. And it's called Kweyan's Eyebrows. The Japanized version is Suigan. But Kweyan is not that difficult, so let's go with Kweyan. At the end of the summer training period, Kweyan spoke to the assembly, saying, "All summer long I have been talking to you, brothers. Look and see if my eyebrows are still there." And now I'm going to revert to the Japanized versions of these Chinese masters. Hofuku said, "A thief has a guilty conscience." Choke said, "They have grown." Ummon said, "Kan," or barrier. Reading now from Zen's Chinese Heritage, Kweyan. We don't have any dates for him, but he was early. He was like 800s and was a disciple of the great Shui Feng, or Seppo. And was one of the foremost students and Dharma heirs of Seppo. I don't have any biographical material, but do have some dialogues he was part of. A monk came forward to him in the hall once and said, "Without words, I ask the master to speak." Kweyan said, "Go in shame to the tea hall." A monk asked, "What is the meaning of the national teacher's three calls to his attendant?" This is another koan. Kweyan said, "What point is there in looking up to or down at other people?" A monk said, "A speck of dust turns into cinnabar, and with one touch, iron turns to gold. A single phrase becomes vast wisdom, and a commoner, a saint. I have come here to ask the master for a touch." So this, you can see, is no beginner. He wouldn't have such a preamble, such a well-thought-out question. If he were a beginner, one touch, iron turns to gold. So I've come here to ask the master for a touch. Kweyan said, "I won't touch you." The monk said, "Why not?" Kweyan said, "I'm afraid you'll fall into discriminating between mundane and sacred." A monk asked, "What is the most profound teaching you offer?" Kweyan called to his attendant, "Come and boil some tea." A monk asked, when all of the words and phrases of the mysterious function are exhausted, but the central matter of our school's great vehicle is not understood, then what? Kwayan said, bow. The monk said, I don't understand. Kwayan said, you've left home to go on a pilgrimage, but you still don't know how to bow? This points to how wonderfully concrete Zen is. It's no wonder that it would take to a culture that values doing over thinking about. For example, I once wrote a book called Zen and the Bible, and I'm always trying to expose myself to the Bible, or I used to always try to expose myself to the Bible, since I got none when I was a kid. The author observed that one of the differences between Westerners and Asians is that Asians are more likely to be willing to go by the authority of whoever, the teacher or the boss or whatever, and do what's asked in the faith that from the doing of it will come understanding. Whereas Westerners, Roshi always used to say this too, Westerners more commonly start from a more skeptical point of view and want to know reasons why. Why should I bow? Why should I do a prostration? And then if you explain that it's a way of embodying this fundamental unity or reverence toward our Buddha nature and lowering the horizontalizing the mast of ego and affirming one's Buddha nature, then that can help. And okay, all right, I'll have a go at it. But according to this man, Asians are more likely to just do it out of respect and faith in the tradition or the one who is presenting the tradition. And as most of us know, it is by doing it, doing whatever. We learn this in Sesshin too, where there's so many procedures and things. If we can just no-mindedly do what is called for, then the wisdom behind these rituals and other prescribed ways of doing things, the wisdom behind them grows into us. We come to appreciate doing these things. Has more of an impact on us to physically do something that embodies a certain teaching or a certain spirit rather than thinking about it. And this is what's behind chanting also. Whenever we vocalize something, then we are to some degree embodying it. We get our body involved with, even if we're not moving, our larynx and tongue and all are getting engaged. And this brings us into a closer understanding of what we're chanting or what we're reciting than just reading it on a page. This is also why we do the vocalizing of mu or hu on the last night of Sesshin. It's a whole different way of working with the koan. So one more story involving Kuan. An abbot of a monastery invited Kuan to a meal on the occasion of a lecture on the teachings of the Flower Ornament Sutra. Kuan said, "I have a question. If you can answer it, then I'll partake of the meal." Then he held up a sesame cake and said, "Does this contain the body of reality?" The body of reality is a term, a concept that is very much at the center of this particular sutra. "Does this contain the body of reality?" The abbot said, "Yes." Kuan said, "Then I eat the body of reality." The abbot had no reply. The monk who gave the lecture said on behalf of the abbot, "What fault is there in that?" Kuan didn't agree. This silence of the abbot, it's one of the recurring challenges in working on koans, is to understand what type of silence, when a monk or a master is silent, to understand what's behind it, whether it's just the person being stymied and not knowing what to say, or whether there is something, some real wisdom behind it. We all know this. As adults, we know, we've been around long enough that we know that when someone at work or one of our kids or one of our spouse is silent, there can mean different things depending on the timing and the circumstances and all. That's all. The koans are nothing alien to us. They just force us to look more deeply into what in daily life would just slip past us. So now back to the case. Kuaishan's eyebrows. At the end of the summer training period, Kuaishan spoke to the assembly, saying, a summer training period would refer to what in Japanese Zen is called the ango. It's still common today in training temples in Japan to have 3-month angos once or twice a year. And we used to follow that tradition here where we didn't call them ango, we called them an on period. They alternated with the seasons. So in the spring and fall would be our on periods. That was the only time we had 7-day sesshins, in the spring and fall. And then in the summer and winter, we might have 1 or 2 short sesshins. But these we call the off period. When I took over, I felt that winter is just too perfect a time to go into sesshin, and summer was when the only time that many teachers and students could come to sesshin. So we sort of spread them out around the year. But this would have been after an intensification of training and practice. And then Kuai Shan made this statement: "All summer long I've been talking to you, brothers. Look and see if my eyebrows are still there." One of the sources said that he was the head monk during that training period, that summer training period. And these three, Hofuku, Choke, and Ummon, were his brother monks. They all became distinguished, great, great, famous Zen masters. They were his brother monks. All of them were the leading disciples. All four of them were leading disciples of this Seppo or Shuaifang. And he makes this statement: "Look and see if my eyebrows are still there." Okay, this is where in koans we have to give people a little insight into what kind of cultural reference this is. It was said in Buddhism that if you teach falsely, you lose your eyebrows. Now, that wasn't purely random notion. It came from the belief that, the fact that if you got leprosy, you would lose your eyebrows, and that leprosy was a kind of hell. So it's really a way of saying, look and see if I have taught falsely, have betrayed the Dharma, and consigned myself to hell. It's easy to read this and figure that Kuai Shan had some self-doubt working here, that in this august company of these three great enlightened brother monks of his, that he was wondering whether he had blown it. And there, all three of these other guys were older than him, so that would make it certainly understandable if he was uneasy about what he'd been teaching. But if he was holding his own with these three, and as head monk he would have been, we can't be sure that that's what was going on, that he was feeling uneasy and he wanted some affirmation from them. Could this also have been at the same time, or instead, a challenge of some kind? Such as, what would you say about what I've been teaching? I've had my chance, now what would you say? It says a lot. Either way you interpret this statement of Kuai Shan's, either way it says a lot about his fortitude, his character, that he's stepping up to the plate and opening himself up to this. Somehow when I read this this time, I was reminded of something attributed to the Buddha that he said in this collection of sayings and called the Dhammapada. People will blame you if you say too much. They will blame you if you say too little. They will blame you if you say just enough. Sounds like modern politics. And then first, Hofuku said, a thief has a guilty conscience. I don't think it's giving away too much to say that in Zen, thief has a special meaning in relation to stripping the student of his or her unnecessary baggage. Concepts and thoughts, notions. It's interesting, in my review of the different translations of this koan this morning, I found four different translations of this line. In ours that we use in our workbooks, a thief has a guilty conscience. In another one, a man who is a thief has a timid heart. A third one, the thief's heart is cowardly. Anyway, that's just those. Okay, just those three. But one of the things that makes koan study more complicated than it would be already is having these different translations. The Chinese language is very imprecise, and it leaves itself open to different interpretations, different translations. A thief has a guilty conscience. So much of these statements and responses in the koans also are a matter of how the person said it. There's the words, but then there's also the different ways that the words can be spoken. In a commentary on this koan, from this koan appears in the Shoyoroku as well as the Blue Cliff Record, and in the Shoyoroku, the commentary by the master who compiled it goes like this: many people in various places. This is referring to Kueshan's initial statement about his eyebrows. Many people in various places say that he basically wanted to confess himself. Then, seeing Hofuku say, the thief's heart is cowardly, they just say he stuck firewood on his back and hid his own fault of speech. Fo Guo, apparently some other master, said, many people misunderstand and say, under the bright sun and the blue sky, he spoke without reason, creating an issue where there is none, confessing his own error first to avoid being checked by others. And then the editor here says, fortunately, this has nothing to do with it. And then the next Master Choke said, "They have grown. They have grown." Well, it would seem that if teaching falsely causes you to lose your eyebrows, then to say they have grown would be praise, approval. Here's another comment from the Shoyoroku. Some say a whole summer of growing branches and sending out creepers from entangling vines. Now he cuts the growth, getting rid of the roots, slashing them away equally all at once. This reference, a whole summer of growing branches and sending out creepers from entangling vines, would be a kind of a wry comment about a teacher using words and how treacherous words can be and how much they can obscure the truth. Zen Master Lin Chi said, "To speak of a thing is to miss the mark." But here too, it's how one speaks. There are teachers who type out their teishos and read them straight. I can't imagine that. It's not a teisho. A teisho has to be somewhat. Extemporaneous, off the cuff. If it's prepared ahead of time, then it's not of this moment. It's gone. It's dead. It draws its life, to the degree that it has any, draws its life from its presence. Finally, Umong gets the last word. Umong was famous for his one-word responses, or it really means one character. Some Chinese characters have, when translated, have more than one word. But and then he said, "Kan, Kan, barrier." This is the real challenge of this koan, is this last line, this utterance of Umon. Many a student has sweated over this response, including a Chinese master who worked on this while he was still a monk. He worked on this line, Khan, for 6 years and before coming to deep enlightenment. This is the Khan of Mumon Khan. Mumon Khan, the collection of koans, the title of the collection of koans, means gateless barrier. It's gateless barrier, of course, is a no barrier. Roshi Kaplow once used the analogy of crossing an international boundary line, or well, even a let's say a state. A state boundary line. Let's say you're going from So let's say it's a wooded area, and you cross this line that's not there. What's the change? Well, in a sense, there's a change. You're now in a new country, a new state at least. I think of this kind of wild, long, 1,000-mile-long boundary area between Canada and the United States. I've never been up there, but we can imagine you're up there in the wilderness and you take 10 steps and you're in another country. What's changed? It's a kind of a barrier, but it's not a barrier. It's the same with mu. It's the same with who am I? What is it? It's there, but it's not there. When you're on your own side before crossing, it seems very much like a barrier. But once you step over the line, then you see it for what it is, nothing. There's a verse here referring to this matter of a barrier. This is from a master quoted in another commentary on this koan. How pitiful, how very pitiful, to search for dry ashes in the waves of the sea. If you would only withdraw your hands at that moment, it would come. If only you would stop looking outside yourself. If only you would stop thinking about yourself. As having it or not having it, doing it or not doing it, attaining it or not attaining it. Zen is a teaching that's a no teaching. We set up these koans and other barriers only to impel us to see that what seems to be something is nothing. And at the same time is something in its own way. The one line that I know of from the Lankavatara Sutra, which was the sutra favored most by Bodhidharma, goes like this. Things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. It's another koan. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.